I get the distinct honor of bringing the demise of Absalom in the next 2 weeks, and the fruit of David's family. Essentially, God told David that the sword would never depart from his house, and we get to see the fruit of that. And it's sad because David is a hero of the faith, and we get to read, it's history, and it can be dry, and it can be, unexciting. However, the idea is to find things that apply and interesting tidbits that you can wrap your head around and go, look, these people are 3,000 years old. This is a real story, and these people really experienced life just like I do, but without certain modern day conveniences. And the things that they walked through with a holy God, and it's all available to me. And it's even different now because I live on this side of the cross versus that side of the cross. So in chapter 15, we find ourselves with Absalom having been reestablished in the royal family, and he has dealt with Joab in chapter 14, and I think that you get to see a little bit of just how wily and Machiavellian Absalom is. If you don't know who Machiavelli is, Machiavelli was a writer about 550 years ago. He wrote a famous piece called The Prince, and it essentially talked about ruling, and that princes in ruling need to be much less concerned about morality and more concerned about how to retain power. And these are some of the things you do to retain power. And scapegoating, if you've ever heard of scapegoating, Machiavelli was big into how to turn somebody into a scapegoat. And so what you're watching Absalom do is to steal away the affection of the leading citizens of Jerusalem. And so without further ado, 2 Samuel chapter 15. I will read a portion, and then we will comment and talk and cross-talk, and then I'll continue. After this that had happened, Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice." And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted towards all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So what we see is in chapter 14, Absalom had gone and he had approached Joab, and using a ruse, basically, to establish himself in the royal family. So now Absalom is circumventing the authority of his father's counselors. And in those days, if you had a concern, the city gates are where the commerce would come and go. And so during the day, you would have a market, sometimes outside the city, sometimes in. Obviously with Jerusalem, it would come inside because it was at the city gates. And they would, if you had a matter that needed to be adjudicated, you would come and you would seek one of the king's justices, okay, and they would adjudicate your case. You had a neighbor dispute over land. You had a money dispute. You have a contractual dispute. There were things that needed to be settled inside of, just like today. I need my title redone. Well, where do you go? Well, we would go to the DMV. Well, in those days, you'd go to the city gates. And if it needed to be pushed up higher, then you could seek audience with the king. There were things that you could do. But this is where it started. Was, well, so Absalom is literally going right out in front of the normal course, and he's approaching people as they come in. And he's essentially using his personality. He was obviously very personable, and he had long flowing hair, we learn later. And he was able to use his natural, what you would think would be charismatic gifting, but that would be, let's not make that application like a New Testament, okay? Let's just say he was somebody who knew how to say the right thing. Like he was somebody who, he was kind of a player, right? He was like a televangelist, all right? Somebody who could stand up and he could make a case, whether it's true or not, but he was very inviting and warm, and Absalom was that. And he had the benefit of being one of the king's sons, right? So he was raised in the royal household, he knew all the lingo, he had all the family connections, all right? Now, how widespread it was, the Amnon issue, all right, we don't know. All right, we do know there were counselors, and we went through that with Amnon dying. But at this point in time, this is years later, okay, several years later, and there's a transcribed error that talks about 40 years. It couldn't have possibly been 40 years here in a minute. But so the problem that the people were having was Absalom would have been in the line to perhaps be king. But if in a monarchy, as it were, but that's not how God was going to make it work. So the people were thinking that, you know, it wasn't like it was being disloyal to David. So I know in the story, because you see that Joab is not a fan of Absalom later on. We're going to read that. And Joab winds up killing Absalom. But at this point in time, Absalom hasn't done anything treasonous yet. All right? But what he's doing is he's gathering his support of the main people of Israel. And he's just telling them what they want to hear. You know, it's like our politicians would do today, where they go to a people group and they say to a group of industrialists, we're going to lower regulation and we're going to cut taxes. And then 2 days later, they go to a different speech and they go to a group of people that are on subsidized housing, and they talk about how they're going to build more subsidized housing. And they go and they start telling all these different groups what they want to hear. Well, what happens? They don't plan on doing any of this stuff, what they may absolutely have to, but they're saying what they need to do to gather support. And that's what Absalom is doing right now. He's consolidating his support. And this goes back to the you know, what one of the Proverbs said is, you know, when you first hear a matter, it seems right, but you're not to act on it, because you need to hear the whole matter. How many times in life are we one of those people, like I, because I'm guilty of having done exactly what these people dealing with Absalom did. You hear what seems plausible and what seems correct, and it all makes sense, and then you agree with it, and then later do I realize I didn't use good judgment. That was wrong. I've wasted my time. I've wasted my resources. I put my support behind something that's unworthy, because I didn't do my research. I didn't look at the whole matter. And Proverbs is very quick to that. And usually it's an emotional appeal. And that's exactly what Absalom was doing, is making an emotional appeal. Oh, if I were only king, I would so find in your favor. You're so right. You're so right. You know what? I feel for you. If only I could do something when I become king, hey, come here. Write this down. When I'm king, I will, oh yeah. You, right on. You know that guy, right? We all know that guy. We've all met that guy, right? Okay.
Watch him on TV.
Well, if you haven't met him, he's out there. Go to any car lot. In verse 7, and this is the this would be what they think is probably a transcribed error. because there are versions. And when I say an error, what I mean is that in Hebrew, the little lines and dots and tittles that make up the Hebrew alphabet are very easily, when they are transcribed by hand, messed up. And many times in the books of Kings and Chronicles and Samuel, you will see numbers written down, because and the numbers are represented by a word. It's not, it doesn't work like ours does now where it's completely separate, okay? So it's one little dot. So in some manuscripts, it has it as 4 years. In the Masoretic text, which is what this is based on, it has it as 40. Well, it couldn't possibly be 40 years because David's entire reign was 40 years. Okay, so the King James, the New King James, use the text that says 40. Is it a big deal? There's several of them like this. So if you ever read about the errors in the Bible, they'll bring these up. And this would be one that they would say, well, obviously the Bible can't be true. Well, this story is 3,000 years old, okay? The text we have for this story is 2,000 years old in Hebrew on a parchment, okay? So it's 1,000 years between the time, and that's having one little dot out of place when it's been hand transcribed. That's not so bad.
And if I could just say one thing, one of the reasons why it can't be 40 years is because that was how long David's reign was.
Right.
So that's the reason why.
I mean, I could go and show you, like, I could take out the timeline and go, okay, well, this was probably this many years in, but just think like this. Absalom was David's son. David had been reigning in Hebron for 7 years, then he was reigning in Jerusalem. This is during the time he reigned in Jerusalem, about halfway through, and now Absalom, there's no way it could be 40 because then David's reign would have been a lot longer. So this is about 4 years. Said to the king, verse 7, please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said to him, go in peace, and he arose and went to Hebron. And Absalom sent spies throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. And when Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gileonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices and the conspiracy grew stronger, for the people with Absalom continued to increase in number. I think it's interesting that the compiler of this work made sure to let the reader know that the people that went with Absalom didn't know. They were innocent of the plot. So Absalom, the entire thing was a setup. He's going to go to Hebron, and he's going to have himself declared king back where David started this whole deal, before he came to Jerusalem, and he's going to bring a bunch of the leading people. Well, what did Absalom not have on his side in his little plot here? He didn't have the army, okay? And Joab ran the army, and Joab was a bloodthirsty, very effective man at killing and ordering people killed and taking over cities, and he was, his family, him and his brother, well, his other brother is dead by this point, but they were feared, fierce warriors. Now a messenger came to David, verse 13, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So we get to hear, before I go on, we get to hear about Ahithophel. And Ahithophel is, would be the grandfather of Bathsheba. Now, It is surmised that Ahithophel probably was unhappy with the arrangement. Maybe not, but you would think that having his son-in-law, or I mean his grandson-in-law, killed by the king, if he knew that that was the shenanigans that went on, that would probably have displeased him. Now, his granddaughter did marry into the royal family, And we'll see further on that Ahithophel is looked on as a very wise counselor. And this was a real blow. Like this, Ahithophel throwing his support behind Absalom seems very, it would seem out of character for somebody who is wise as Ahithophel. Like this, because from the outside, it doesn't appear that Absalom has a chance of making this coup d'etat work, because David has the army. Ahithophel would be wise enough to read the what's going on and go, this is going to end bad. Why would I? Because this is treason. What Ahithophel is doing is treason, and treason has been dealt with pretty much one way throughout history: execution. Okay, but that's generally it's a capital crime. When you commit treason, it's a capital crime. So Ahithophel, very wise counselor, one of David's wise counselors, Bathsheba's grandfather, is throwing his support behind Absalom. Now a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Verse 14, so David said to all his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, or we shall not escape Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. And the king went out with his household after him, but the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep his house. And the king went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts. And all the servants passed before him, all the Cherethites, all the Pelethites, all the Gittites, 600 men who followed him from Gath, passed before the king. I'll stop at verse 18. These were not native of the 12 tribes. Okay, these were Philistine mercenaries that were, as we'll see, very loyal to David. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king. For you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. Now see the language that's used right there? David is telling Ittai, he's saying, you can get work as like royal guards are generally not throughout history. It's an interesting study. If you want to do an interesting study, which I'm sure you don't, but if you did, because it's anyhow, you hire royal guards not of your ethnicity, okay, not of your of your tribal area, or because what happens is now they're strictly there based on the money that you've paid them, and you give them, it's a great honor, essentially, and you pay them really well. That way they're not going to be swept away in some kind of coup. You get your brother-in-law to do it, or somebody, or your son. Next thing you know, you don't wake up one night because there's been a coup. So throughout history, having someone outside of your line who's loyal to you through, and these guys were taken care of because they were paid mercenaries, and they had been through David's campaigns, and like I said, Joab, whatever structure David and Joab set up for their military and what the inner workings were, they were extremely effective, and these guys were part of that, and so they were. We'll just get to see here how loyal they are to David, even though they were Philistines. But Ittai answered the king and said, verse 21. Oh, sorry. In verse 20. In fact, then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why are you also going with us? Remain and return with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. In fact, you came only yesterday. Should I make you wander up and down with us today, since I go, I know not where? Return and take your brethren back. Mercy and truth be with you. But Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in life or death, even there also your servant will be. So David said to Ittai, go and cross over. And Ittai the Gittite and all his men and all the little ones who were with him crossed over. David wanted to make sure that Ittai understood that should Absalom prevail in this deal, that Ittai was going to be on the outs with the new regime. The incoming regime was not going to be so friendly to David's paid mercenaries. And Ittai had just showed up on the scene. All the Perathites, he was the new leader guy, as it were. But he knew, I mean, he called out and said, no, as Jehovah lives. Okay, so he was he'd been either converted or was a God-fearer of some sort. And he went with David, wisely went with David. And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over, the people with David. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over towards the way of the wilderness. And there was Zadok also, and the Levites with him, bearing the ark of the covenant of God. They set down the ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. But if he says thus, I have no delight in you, here I am, let him do with me as it seems good to him. And the king said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, you and your sons with you, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. Okay, I'm going to stop there. So the scene goes like this. Remember, David presided over the ark coming into Jerusalem. Before David, Jerusalem was a foreign city, right? The ark was in was literally in someone's house, because the Philistines, and remember, you go all the way back to how we started this, right? With the Eli and the ark and the sons, and then the ark came back from the Philistines, and they left it in someone's house. So David presided over this procession coming in, and there was a massive party, and there was a lot of food, and people remembered that David had danced before the Lord and honored God. Look what the priests are doing. They literally, David's leaving? We're taking the ark and going. We're going to go. Didn't even look like they didn't even consult David. They just went. They grabbed the ark. They grabbed the stuff. We need the Levites. We're leaving. Let's go now. They grabbed it. They're carrying it out. And David's like, they get out. And David's like, wait, you guys. And it was probably, I mean, think about it. That must have really melted David's heart. Here's these guys. They have a prescribed, their entire line. The Levites, and then that one family of the Levites, Aaron's family, the priests, they were told, this is what your job is. And this, David, we want to follow you wherever you go. You know, you're the guy. You're God's anointed. And David's like, wait, this, you need to stay. Stay in Jerusalem. You can basically send me information, and if I come back, great. But this is way bigger than just me. Very humble. And the scene, I mean, because there's hundreds and hundreds of people. Baggage carrier, and there's mercenaries. I mean, this isn't like three guys and two priests in a box. There's a ton of people and a massive baggage train. And here's a picture of, lest we think, so I'm going to read the rest of it in its entirety, but think about this: when the disciples, the night that Jesus was betrayed, think about this right here, and they'd heard this story. Okay, this was a famous story of David. Think about this. Okay, David's son betrays him. David has to flee Jerusalem. Okay, verse 30. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot, and all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up, weeping as they went. Then someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray turned the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain where he worshiped God, where he worshiped God, there was Hushai, the Archite, coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, if you go on with me, then you will become a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I was your father's servant previously, so I will now be your servant, then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And do you not have Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, with you there? Therefore it will be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall tell Zadok and Abiathar, the priest. Indeed, they have there with them their two sons, Amahaz and Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Okay, so David's exiting. His friend comes up. His friend is mourning because he's heard the king has got to make a hasty escape because his murderous, bloodthirsty son is planned a coup, and David's got to bail. I'll go with David. Whether he was old, infirmed, or what he meant by the you'll become a burden, we don't know. There's nothing internal that would say. But David did have confidence that he could send him back into Jerusalem, and hopefully he could overturn the counsel of Ahithophel, which he does. But remember, this is all happening right where the soldiers came and arrested Jesus. This whole scene, they crossed over the brook Kidron. He's walking up the Mount of Olives, the same exact place where the soldiers came to Jesus 1,000 years later. This exact area right outside Jerusalem, okay? And it was, God knew. You know, Jesus knew this story and the picture and the confirmation that it was going to give to the disciples. That's why it happened there. He picked the place. Remember in John, he's standing there and he says, who do you seek? Jesus of Nazareth. And he's, I am he. And they all fell down. Jesus was in control of the whole deal. There was no question of, he could have walked right through and right by, and they could have never touched him if he hadn't allowed it. And he told Peter that. I can call legions of angels down, Peter. So David gets betrayed by his son, and we're left with David has essentially set spies up that will come back and inform from the priestly family and a counselor, and there's other people. But remember, David has the army. Okay, we have heard nothing about Joab yet. In the next chapter, we will. And then I'll get to one of my favorite stories in the life of David. I don't know why, it just is. But in chapter 16. Oh, anybody have anything? Any comment, question? David's kids?
In that verse that you read, it said something about the little ones were too.
All of his kids. All of his kids and all his servants' kids and everybody. Because like when one group would take over another group, generally it was everybody got executed. And just remember, there was no, like, it's difficult, the comment I made a couple weeks ago, it's difficult for us to wrap our head around, like, we know of at least eight wives that David had, and he had lots of sons and daughters. Okay, so it's not like everybody just lived in a big tent and got along and all went out and worked the fields and sang songs and held hands and prayed. Okay, we've already had one very visible murder. Okay, and one defilement, and there was competition, and there was hard feelings, and it wasn't rosy at all, because polygamous relationships in general throughout history, you don't read of them really, I mean, you have to have some extraordinary people for them to work out. I'm not saying they can't, I'm saying that this is a pretty good example of the sword not parting from David's house so much as a curse or a judgment from God, It would have been very difficult if God hadn't have been directly involved, if those kids hadn't been at each other's throat, because it was the royal family, and there was a lot of power at stake. And so I think him just pulling his support back for kept him good. Don't know. I think we're supposed to surmise that how his heart was turned towards Absalom, that John asks a very relevant question. David's fleeing at this time from Jerusalem seems very out of character. It seems unwise is what he's doing. Because David has the army and he's got plenty of support. But I think further on in the story, what we're supposed to understand is that David was so soft-hearted towards his children, there was no possible way, because he knew what the punishment for this was. He'd already banished the guy and ignored him and not dealt with him, and now he's just outright staged a coup. And so not only is he a murderer, but now he staged a coup, and now he's going to have to deal with him, and he can't bear it. Because his reaction when Joab finally does put a spear through him is just, he loses it. And Joab's going to tell him, he said, you cannot mourn a traitorous son. Get up. That's paraphrase, but.
So it's almost like maybe you could say that David had so much of an advantage over Absalom that by fleeing, he actually made it more like a fair fight.
I think if you look at how David basically ordered everybody, do not do this, do not do this, do not touch Absalom. And then later we read the guy's telling Joab, he tells Joab, I'm stealing from the next week, but basically when Absalom finally meets his final demise at Joab's hands, Joab asks somebody about where he's at, and the guy says, well, I wasn't going to touch him, I heard the king, and I know if I'd have done something, you'd have turned your back on me. And that was the point, is that I guess David made it very clear that you're not to touch Absalom. And so I think that was his heart. I don't think he, and I think the like your point is that if he would have stayed and Absalom rode up with all these men and it was a battle, that Absalom's dead. Yeah, because Joab just would have rode right down and killed him. Right there. No problem. I mean, Joab, that's a threat right there. Take it out. Doesn't matter who it is.
You know, I have to wonder how much David really was aware of the fact that he's the anointed. He's the one that was chosen for this task. And therefore, there was probably some invincibility in his mind. And I say that because I look at some of the Psalms that coincide with this, like Psalm 3. It says, the Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom. Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are those who say of me, there is no help. There is no help for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. And he keeps going on as if everything is okay. And I'm just wondering if that's why he kind of just stepped out of the way, because he knew things were under control. It's hard to say.
That could be. Okay, we'll go through half of chapter 16 and then we'll be done. There's two stories. The first one's kind of disappointing, but then David, when David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisin, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. It's very reminiscent of Abigail and earlier in David's reign, or David's life, prior to becoming king. Abigail met David on the way with this. There must have been something customary about this, like leading out all your produce to meet someone, as it were. And the king said to Ziba, "What do you mean to do with these?" And Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine is for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" And Ziba said, Mephibosheth. And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will be restored to the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I humbly bow before you, that I might find favor in your sight, O Lord, my Lord, O King. Okay, the actors here are Mephibosheth was Saul's remaining son. Ziba was his very wealthy servant of Saul, who David had shown kindness to Mephibosheth by restoring a bunch of Saul's lands and then hence incomes to Mephibosheth. Now, Ziba was somebody who David had essentially tasked through royal decree to administrate all of this for Mephibosheth. So now we see that Ziba is taking an opportunity to ingratiate himself to David. Why he would say it seemed very implausible what he said. Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. Lying, that's most likely a lie. Mephibosheth could not have thought that Absalom coming to power was somehow going to make the latter Saul's reign, Saul's line, was somehow going to get put back on the throne because of it. It seems desperate, and unfortunately for David, he didn't really check it out. He just, royal decree, bang, okay, fine, take all his stuff, it's fine, whatever, and didn't look into the matter any further. However, you'll notice he was literally cresting, leaving. He was just on the other side of the mountain from Jerusalem when Ziba came up. We get to end on this really good story. Verse 5. Now, when King David came to Behurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said thus as he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought you out among all the blood, has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom of the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you are a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, this is Joab's brother, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? That's a big insult. Calling someone a dog was really bad. Calling someone a dead dog was doubly bad. You dirty dead dog. Okay. Double dog, there you go. This is a high insult, calling somebody a dead dog. Curse my lord the king. Please let me go over and take off his head. Okay, no problem. He cursed the king. He said something. Okay, think about it. You're fleeing from an invasion of your treacherous son. Someone comes out and is throwing rocks at your procession. And Abishai's answer to that is, David, let me just go behead him right in front of everybody. Right? Well, that kind of solves, I mean, that takes out the, you know, all detractors have a tendency to kind of go away at that point. There's a headless body in the roadway. Verse 10, but the king said, what have I to do with you, the sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and his servants, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite, let him alone, let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look upon my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. And David and his men went along the road, and Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him and kicked up dust. And the king and all the people who were with him became weary, so they refreshed themselves there. Okay, so it's not as though Shimei just came out and said, hey, you're a bad king. Okay, Shimei was making he was out of control. Like, and the, you know, it's not like he had like a little gravel pit. I mean, these were rocks. It's really rocky over there. And he was hucking rocks and being a pain. What did he mean?
I always picture the story of Princess Bride with that one lady.
Yeah.
Every time I read this, that's what I think of.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And it's interesting because David was very deliberate in his dealings with Saul's family. And David, from what we read in the royal account, David didn't go after any of them. The one thing that Shimei might be referring to is that David turned over 7 members of Saul's household to, was it the Gibeonites? I think it was the Gibeonites. Because Saul had dealt treacherously with the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites demanded blood. And so that was the deal, and David said, take 7 members of Saul's household, deliver them to the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites just killed them. That's the only internal evidence we have of what Shimei could be talking about. Maybe they came and got Shimei's kids. We don't know. Okay, but we know that this guy was of Saul's household, and he was not happy with David. It may have just been as simple as he was in government office, or having Saul in leadership was good for him and his business, and having David in leadership wasn't. And so it seems very silly for him, having known who these people are, to be out throwing rocks at the mighty men. So now we see the mighty men were with David. Okay, so David's entire, not only mercenary bodyguard, but all the guys that had done war with David were with him, okay? And so that sets up the physical, the who's, the what, the how. Look at what David said, okay? And I would challenge everybody in the room, okay? The next time you get a flat tire, the next time someone takes advantage of you, just say what David said to yourself. And own it. Just own it as a principle. Okay? Who shall say, curse David, who shall say, why have ye done so? How much more, let him alone, let him curse. So maybe the Lord had ordered him to do so. You get the picture? Like, David's basically saying, for all you know, this guy is an instrument of something. David doesn't ask why. I mean, he doesn't say, you know, there's these 16 reasons it could be, and I'm a just king, and he did this, okay? No, he just says, maybe the Lord's in this, most likely. I don't know. It's part of the plan. It's providential. And this is very freeing. This story has always been very freeing for me, because I can look to this and I can go, okay, here's a guy who was selected, anointed, was blessed by God, who had his failings, who was used mightily. I mean, massive stories about him, was a pivotal point in an entire, the children of Israel, an entire family, an entire nation revolved around this kingdom of what he was able to set up. And then the pictures were all used of messianic pictures in the New Testament. And he just says it really simple, that principle of God's in control, okay? He's throwing rocks. He's being insulting. I'm not going to overreact. God's in control. It's okay. And the really difficult part is saying, like he said, that the Lord will repay. Okay, it's in God's hands, is what he said. It's in God's hands. Now, you'll remember, so when we get to the end of this deal, what happens is he tells Solomon flat out, oh yeah, and Shimei, you deal with that guy when I'm dead. Okay, you deal with Joab, and you deal with Shimei. We're two of the unfinished business. David said, I won't in my lifetime. You take care of it. And basically Solomon took and told Shimei, hey Shimei, you will not leave this area. You do, you're a dead man. And Shimei went, oh, no problem, no problem, no problem. And then his donkey got loose and he chased his donkey, and Solomon beheaded him. It was like 2 years into his reign or whatever. Just no, boom, just dealt with him because he said he appeared to be a treacherous guy. So there we're going to leave it. Yeah, and I just challenge you to look at that story, and it's being mocked and jeered. And I mean, like I said, David had hundreds of mercenaries and hundreds of armed soldiers and lots of food and donkeys and his family and his wives and little kids and servants. There had to be thousands of people with him. Thousands of people were traveling. And there's one guy standing off in the distance screaming and yelling and throwing rocks and being annoying and being embarrassing. And David just went. So if every instance like that, because we're never traveling like that. I don't think anybody in the room's ever traveled like that. None of us are kings. Okay? You know, I mean, usually it feels very overwhelming. Like in this story, you know, it seems like David is one more kick and he's down, right? But in reality, in spiritually, this is really where we're at. We do have all the resources that David did spiritually. We do have all the battle, all the armor. It's all won. It's already won. We're just on cleanup duty. We're the ones that just need to go out there and love. And that's what love looked like right here, was telling Abishai, no, don't go chop his head off. All right, don't. God's in this. All right, not only that, Abishai, I deserve it. Okay, he's right. And ultimately, I think, for me personally, that's generally what is easier for me, is that when we deal in life and people are rude and we're disappointed and things happen, and it's easy to try and say, hey, my rights are the most important, which David could have done. He was king. And Shimei was being unjust because David had been very fair to Saul's household. He could have said, you know, no, it's about my rights. But we as Christians aren't called to do that. We as Christians are called to show mercy. And love looks like laying down your rights. And to say, you know what? It's okay. I don't need to uphold my rights right now.
Don't you think that David's refusal to allow him to be killed, and David saying something about maybe this is God's will, don't you think that David was feeling repentance and remorse for his treatment of Absalom that really brought all of this about, brought Absalom to try to take over the throne and all of that, and how David had failed Absalom so much in his life? It seems to me that David was feeling that and realizing that therefore the Lord maybe allowed this to happen.
Could be. I think that David probably heard the words of Nathan when he saw Shimei doing that, and you know, behold, I will raise up adversity from you in your own house, from your own house, and I will take your wives before you. And I think he basically, when he saw that, he could. It would be natural, I think, for us if you had a prophet come to you and rebuke you. And then say, you know, no, you're not going to suffer the penalty, but of death. But I have a bigger purpose. However, the sword will not depart from your house. There's going to be adversity. I think that's probably what David. Because it seems like he was just a little down. His instant reaction was, we need to leave Jerusalem. And everybody got up. The army, the heads of the army, the mighty men, his mercenaries, his family, and the priests got up to leave, and he's telling the priest, no, wait, go back. And yeah, I'm sure he looks back and sees his adult son who'd rebelled. Yeah, that was probably quite the blow. Okay. Anybody else? How many years? It was at least, well, let's see. It was 4 years that Absalom had been back, and then the Tamar incident, that was probably 7, 10, something like that. So Solomon would have been, because Solomon was, the baby died, and then Solomon was born, Bathsheba. Solomon would have been a baby, a little, probably toddler, a little bigger. So Solomon was in the procession. The next king was there, watching his older half-brother try and have a coup, which must have made quite the impression on him. Because later, what we find out is that Solomon, one of the very first things that happened in Solomon's reign was one of his brothers asked for a concubine of David's, which asked for a wife, a slave wife of David, which was essentially asking for the throne, is what he was doing. It was very specific, and Solomon had him killed. So there was not, yeah, Solomon had this event right here probably made quite the impression on a young Solomon, because there was, I mean, they were running for the, all the little kids, you're running for your life, you know, all that trauma of just uprooting and saying, hey, you know, we're going to go on a trip, and everyone's crying. What kind of trip is this where everybody's crying, you know? You know, why is everybody crying, and why is everybody throwing stuff into satchels, and everybody's, and what's all the army doing, and why, this isn't fun.
And I have to wonder if Solomon at that time, little toddler's age, was already the declared next king, and Absalom knew that?
I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe, but I don't know. I'll grab a timeline, and then next week I'll... Because many of these don't, this one has a date, about 4 years, and so it was 2 years, he reigned for 2 years, and it said a couple chapters before, they'll put it together, but you don't know exactly, but I'll tell you about how far through the reign this was. But he'd been in Jerusalem for at least, reigned in Hebron for 7, Jerusalem was at least 10 to 15 at this time, I think, so. He was about halfway through his reign, over half.
So, I wonder if you could say a few words to help people like myself who tend towards conflict avoidance, which I can see David doing right here. Really, how do we overcome that?
I'm probably a horrible person to ask, because I have a tendency to make a mess, and I always admire people that can do it without making a mess. I think when it comes down to what loving somebody looks like, the problem I think David had in this case, well, I shouldn't say the problem I had, that David had. I think in retrospect, seeing David's hasty, you know, conflict resolution at this point would have been very simply to go out and to deal with Absalom when there was the Tamar issue. That was treacherous what he did. And when David found out about it, he could have set those older boys down and they could have literally just had like a round table council, and David would have laid it out and said, this is how it will be, and you are now exiled. I am sorry, I love you, I will come and visit you. But that right there is not going to fly in my kingdom. And that would have been the loving thing to do, in my opinion. Now, this is my opinion only. David was unwilling to do that for whatever reason. One of those other sons was a favorite. He told the, who knows how many of these wives were yanking his ears, you know, what way or the other. Oh, please do it. I'm sorry, because that was probably offensive. Sorry, honey. Well, I didn't. Okay, I've never been involved in a polygamous relationship. I don't know what it's like. I do know what it's like to live with four women and then have an overbearing mother. My point is that opinions start to go, and your heart as a man just, you melt. Like, I'm upset, and I have the, no, I'm so sorry. I don't have that relation with my mom. But I kind of go, well, mom. But the girls, you know, it's different. And I think with David and his relationship with those adult sons, it's easy for us to look and say, oh, look at all the failings that he had with his family, and then the curse was about his family. I think it really just comes down to the inherent problem with polygamy. Especially at the royal line, the royal set like this. I mean, God was very clear. He said, don't multiply wives as king. It's just not a good, the principle is not good to institute, okay? And as a result, David had a very difficult time just setting out these biological relationships, and because then you're elevating everybody. Now everybody's elevated, all right? There's no favorites, there's no this. I mean, you prefer relationships over another, but you try and treat them all the same. And then those conflicts come, and you gotta jump down somebody's throat once in a while and tell them, you can't kill your brother. You know, you can't do these things, you can't. And I think leadership, in David's case, he was the monarch. Yay or nay, and this gets stretched out to the point where finally his general has to kill his own son. And he orders his general not to do the wise thing, and he does, and then he creates more of a problem because everybody heard David say, don't kill my son, and then Joab goes and does it, and David doesn't have the political capital to remove Joab, which we read later, because then Joab just kills the person that goes to replace him. This creates a real problem for David's leadership, his lack of being able to be decisive in making decisions. And so I think what happens, John, is we get converted, we as human beings, and we draw near to the heart of God, and it's very difficult to, we want to err on the side of mercy, and we have a very difficult time being decisive because we're afraid we're going to hurt somebody, and we're afraid we just want to get along. I'm speaking from my own experience. And the problem with that is it's not loving to everybody. Is you're not, you know, and I'm talking about it from a perspective of, I've got 7 kids I've raised with all manner of different biological relationships with them, and some no bio relationships with them, and you have to navigate those relationships. And there's a way to elevate them and to bring it to where you're loving people, and there's a direction you're going to go. And I don't think David saw this from that perspective. I don't know exactly, you know, where he was at in his head at this stage. But yeah, this seems really odd.
It can get messy.
Well, picking everything up and bailing, and the priests and Levites were following him out. I mean, just like that, he had the army. He had the whole thing, and he just chose to advocate the throne. It seems, and this was a throne that God had given him. You know, he's basically unwilling to go and deal with a treacherous son. It speaks of, I mean, when they say, you know, David had the heart of God, it's amazing when you see that. I don't know, what do you think? Right. Well, I think the problem is that others are the ones that wind up paying for it. You know, I look at some of the issues that I've got, you know, 27-year-old. And so you go and you look at your parenting decisions from 20 years ago, and now you get to see the outgrowth of that 20 years later. And what does that look like? Well, if I would have made some different decisions 20 years ago, there would be people today that wouldn't be dealing with really poorly behaved 20-year-olds. Okay. Potentially, I'm not saying, but potentially there would be the opportunity that those issues would not be part of their life because they would have already been dealt with. And because they weren't dealt with, now it spills out in the lives of others. What did you say we were talking about? One of my particularly horridly behaved children, and you said, when parenting reaches its, when you reach the end of your parenting and society, that's kind of where society and the law then take over. You know, we were talking with Russ, and it's true, you know, that's why we have a penal system. You know, because society says, okay, this behavior goes so far. You wouldn't listen to your parents. You wouldn't listen to wise counsel. You wouldn't take the four chances you had before that. Now we're going to put you in a car, in a concrete box. Well, why? Well, because you wouldn't listen to all these. There was no investiture of love in a way that you could hear because of whatever. And there's no blame or this or that. It's what is. And I think in Simon Absalom's life, someone got to him, and he was privileged, and he was a spoiled brat, and no one ever dealt with him. And then he was treacherous, and he killed his brother, and his brother raped his sister. And that's probably just the stuff we heard about. It was probably horrible, the kinds of things those kids did to each other and to others, and the way they acted.